convention this coming weekend. Anybody got any suggestions on that? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW to TechNet.
Before we get to MAR, I've got some preliminary numbers for Joe, WIW.
That's good stuff. Go for it, Mike, and wait for the four beeps.
Okay, I'm going to make the assumption, I can't be off by too many dB, but I'm going to make the assumption that in the AM mode, which I'm talking, I'm going to concentrate on, I'm going to assume he has a 10 kilohertz bandwidth in that receiver. That would sound pretty reasonable for a typical AM system. Okay, so the FCC allows 10 microvolts per meter, 40 dB above 1 microvolt per meter, 10 meters away. So that would be 40 dB above a microvolt, that would be 100 microvolts per meter, measured in a 10 kilohertz bandwidth, which I'm saying is pretty much what Joe did. Now, you want to convert that to power density, 100 microvolts per meter squared, which is 10,000. I rounded off 377 to 400. That works out to be a power density of 25 picowatts per meter squared to meet FCC requirements if the power company for Class B equipment, I'm sorry, Class A equipment. So he has roughly a receiving antenna that has 10 dB of, 10, I'm sorry, a capture area of 10 times. So 25 picowatts per meter squared times 10 is a received power of 250 picowatts, plus or minus a couple of dB. Convert that to dBm, 10 times the log, 250 times 10 to the minus 12, divide by 001. I get minus 66 dBm. Let me drop. As horrifying as it might seem, it looks like the power company is allowed to radiate minus 66 dBm in a 10 kilohertz bandwidth, anywhere from 50 megahertz to 88 megahertz in a 10 kilohertz bandwidth, as long as, you know, within 10 meters of the radiating system. So, Joe, if you were measuring, what'd you say, 10 to 20 dB over S9 minus 70 dBm, I think was the number approximately? Oh, well, the power company's allowed to be minus 66. Again, I could be off a couple of dB, but it sounds like they're within the limits. Back to net.
That's a little bit disappointing, if that's what it turns out to be, Joe. B2RYY, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW.
Well, it does sound disappointing. I mean, you'd be disappointed too if you, had something to hear with a radio band where you couldn't hear reception. Far away. That's where this all came from. Because I used to listen to stuff on a little lower frequency, like in 46 megahertz local wire channels, and I've been wondering the past couple of years using similar, the same kind of receiving equipment, I don't have the range anymore like it used to have as far as receiving what it used to receive. I mean, it's drastically diminished. That's what made me start making these kind of measurements to find out what's going on.
Glenn recognized. One quick question here, Joe. When you drove to the place where you saw the strongest amount of signal from the power line, were you in the rough vicinity of 30 feet away from that power line? What's your guess, Joe? W2RYY? K2RIW?
I was talking to Andy on the phone about this also. I'll give you another information on it in a second. Well, this pole that I'm hearing this from is a junction of, I believe, it's 69 kV lines, because the insulators are about a foot and a half long. They're fairly long, so it's got to be probably 69 kV I'm sitting next to. And those things are way, way above the normal distribution for the neighborhood. It's on like the same pole, and you got one set of wires at one level, and these set of wires are a lot higher than that. They look like they're about 40 feet up above the roadway. So I was at least 30 feet away in a linear, from that junction of these wires, or if not more. Let me just add this also. Listening to the receiver in AM with the R7000, as they drove back and forth along the intersection where these lines seemed to cross, I could hear the noise change in intensity almost at a repetitional rate, like I'm listening to a wavelength on that frequency. If down, up and down, up and down, and it seemed to be, you know, fairly consistent, you know, as I drove away, diminishing as I got about an eighth of a mile away. And I did the same test on, like I said, 29.5 megahertz at 50.1. 50.1, the repetition rate of the noise was a little faster. So maybe believe it wasn't radiating completely from one point in space, but it was being radiated along the power lines.
Yeah, that QSB that you were seeing as you drove is very predictable to some degree. In other words, the line doing the radiating has got a pattern in space, it's a bunch of fingers in space, and you've got multipath going on. So you're driving in between the reflective objects, ground, buildings, water towers, and the complicated structure of the antenna pattern of the line doing the radiating. So you're going to see peaks and valleys. And now, do you choose the highest peak to report to them, or do you choose some kind of an average? There, I don't know. Let's see what Glenn's got to say about all of the above. KC2QIQ, K2RIW and TechNet. You've got it, Glenn. Wait for the four beeps.
KC2IHV, comment.
Yes, just interestingly enough, I kind of have been down this road a few times with some noise sources in mobile. And what I kind of know, the notes that I kind of made on this was basically that, you know, I found there were traffic lights where the crossing signs, when they would come on, they would put out some pretty large chirps. And that when I finally measured that distance, they pretty much were within spec, although it really kind of killed your communication. So it was kind of like you kind of mark those down mentally and just go to another place to operate mobile. From the home QTH, the only thing I found a way of really working around it was just going with altitude. Generally, if you get the antenna high enough, you kind of raise the signal-to-noise ratio so that you can operate. But it's sad to say, but I think that you're going to probably find that most of these sources are really within what they're allowed to be. Back to the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. Good stuff. Let's see what John's got to say. KD2IXB, I'll wait for the four beeps and go right ahead, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
ACP with a comment.
Sometime, a long time ago, somebody told me that when the light doesn't work, you look at the bulb, you don't change the switch, you don't change the wiring. You always look for the simplest thing first. I think it's possible that the gentleman has got two different issues going on here. He may have noise coming from high tension or high voltage line, but he mentioned not being able to hear public safety broadcasting in the 46 megahertz range. Well, in Nassau County, 4610, 4612, 4620, 4632, they've all gone to narrow band as required, which makes them more difficult to hear. If you're using a scanner that's only set for wide band, that may be a separate issue.
Fire band channels are still running wide band in 46 meg region.
Yeah, that FCC mandate where everybody's supposed to go to super narrow FM modulation, I don't think that they've switched over all of that equipment on 46 meg yet. The other communication channels are starting to do that. They're pretty heavy right now. There was another person who said he wanted to make a comment. He said it very fast. The signal was kind of low. It sounded like ACC. Whoever that other person was, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and TechNet. My name is Dick.
I got something for you, Dick.
See, my question to Joe is, are you sure you're hearing actual power line noise, or could you be actually here picking up power line carrier? I don't know if PSEZ, I know they use it on 138, I don't know if they use it on 69 circuits, but the way you're describing it, it sounds very, very much like more of a transmitted signal than just insulator noise. Just curious. KD2HC, back to net.
kind of level are they allowed to radiate if they're carrying communications on those lines? How much can that radiate off of those lines if it's not power line noise?
I can't answer that, Joe. I've never actually worked on circuits utilizing it. We don't use it, but PSE&G, I know they use it on 138 lines. I don't know what the amplitude is that they're transmitting. I don't even know. I'm pretty sure that it's a pulse width communication. Usually it's mostly for SCADA and supervisory stuff. I don't, you know, in digital modes. I do not know how much they're allowed to radiate or how much it would radiate. I'm just, you know, throwing it out there that maybe, you know, you might be looking for a bad insulator, but what you're hearing might actually be a transmitted signal. Just something to think about. KDT, HEC, Betsonet.
Very fine, Steve. He's tuning his receiver in some cases. He's using his R7000. He can tune it across quite a few megacycles, and I can't believe that their signals are that wide. I don't think he's hearing signals. On top of that, the noise he's hearing is there continuously. Those 46 meg transmissions are very brief. Steve, you ordinarily dwell in COMAC. I'm not hearing you on the input. That leads me to believe you're not in COMAC. Is that true, Steve? KC2HUC, K2RIW.
No, I'm in COMAC, but I'm on Echolink tonight. They're making some modifications to my home equipment, so it's not set up right now. As a matter of fact, I sent you an email regarding some of the other stuff we talked about last week. So tonight I'm kind of forced to Echolink. Hopefully it's working all right. KD2HUC.
It's working very well. You sound very good on Echolink. The only trouble is once in a blue moon, when we turn it back to you, the Echolink takes 3 seconds to pick up, and we miss the first 3 seconds, so to speak, of your transmissions. But other than that, that sounds good. So, you've got quite a project there, Joe. Look what you started. And you're eventually going to find out, are they 3 dB below spec or 10 dB above spec? Who is that?
KE2J.
Go ahead, Eric.
All right. As far as the FCC is concerned, if you look up part 15.35, that explains their method of measurement. And their method of measurement is through quasi-peak detectors. Part 15.2.88 shows you diagrammatically as far as power lines and the slant radiators that they consider to be there. So there are actually some real specs as to how to do this. But even as you read their rules, they're somewhat vague about this thing, but that's the reality. And the other thing was, as far as Mr. RYY's IFR, I've got a listing of the resolution bandwidth, depending upon what sweet speed, if you're interested in knowing that.
Yeah, right now, his IFR, he can use at home. It's not portable. I think what he's going to eventually have to do is get some kind of a 12-volt to 120-volt quasi-sine wave converter in his automobile in order to power that IFR. That gives him a spectrum analyzer capability. Right now, I think he's measuring everything on his R7000, because the nice thing about the R7000 is you can feed it either 110 volts or 12 volts. I'm doing a bunch of guessing here. Is that approximately where you're standing there, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, well, it's a problem with the power cord, okay? I have two of these things, I have two power cords. I don't know where the other power cord went, because one of them I can't use. It gets very, very hot. It's missing a part of the power cord that holds the pressure on the fuse. I think it's very hot. This thing probably draws about 15 amps of current on DC. Anyway, running that particular device at home, even at, say, 1 megahertz per division, horizontal scanner with a spectrum analyzer at 1 megahertz per division, I see at, say, 29.5 megahertz, a constant, like, you can hear, like, a type of noise, and I can see it on the analyzer, not broadband-looking noise, which is lower, that's about minus 100, maybe minus 95, but I see other stuff about minus 85 that looks like just impulse, not impulse, but like a power line, like static, continuous static, and occasionally, I will see the whole screen come up to about minus 70 or so. So there's a bad connection also in the neighborhood, too, that's making this stuff all of a sudden radiate a hell of a lot higher than it's supposed to be. But the normal background noise that you see is continuous at about that level.
And when you have your IFR set at 1 megahertz per division, and it's got 10 divisions, that means you're scanning 10 megs. And my guess is the broadband noise with a 60-cycle component is relatively constant across that 10 megs. Is my guess. You're not looking at a coherent transmission where they're sending voice or data. I think you're looking at continuous corona-like or arcing-like noise. Does that approximate what you believe is going on, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW?
At 1 megahertz, it's got 30 kilohertz of resolution bandwidth.
Yeah, well, as I said, the background noise is about, like, minus 95 or so, and I know if I take the antenna off, it goes away. So, you know, that's, I'm seeing a real thing coming down the antenna. That resembles a type of noise where if you go lower and lower in resolution, eventually you lower it on the screen, but you really can't pin it down to one particular thing you're looking at. It looks like it does completely resemble broadband noise, almost like what you look at, like on a, looking at a TV carrier. Digital TV tower, it resembles the same thing. That seems to be fairly constant. Maybe it goes up and down in intensity as they change the frequency, the center of the frequency of span at 1 megahertz per division. But this other impulse noise on top of that is what I heard on the R7000 at this other junction. That's about a quarter mile, not even a quarter mile, but an eighth of a mile away from me. So I may have two things I'm actually looking at once, power line noise. This the background noise may be coming to power line, maybe it's not. I don't have it identified as of right now.
Okay, and the mystery continues. And this one's not going to go away in a hurry. You got a fairly difficult assignment for yourself there. And the total number of hams on Long Island that can make the measurement you're making here, Joe, I can count them on one hand, maybe even less than one hand, if you know what I mean. Both a combination of the knowledge of what the measurements mean and the right kind of test equipment. And you're slowly refining all of the above. You've already done radiating into your base station antenna by a second means, confirming that, yeah, it's really over the air noise. And when you drive around with your automobile and you can find places where it gets stronger, that's pretty strong evidence that it is really a bunch of emitters or at least one major emitter in your neighborhood, which you're eventually going to pin down as to, and I'm kind of amazed, though, that what Mike was giving us earlier, minus 66 dBm is what you might measure on your receiver if they're right at spec, but it's a lot of noise power by my standards. Okay, we're going to go over, let me drop.
Yeah, one other thing, that after you're done with the space report, if you have time, you got like, you know, like maybe an hour's time, maybe less. I have a comment on a product I saw advertised, and I have it up on my computer. I'd like to ask you about that because it seems a little unbelievable what this thing can do, but that's for much later on in the tech net, okay?
Okay. I'll underline your call letters, and we'll be going back to you a little bit later, Joe. The next person with a question is Joe, W2BMP. Go right ahead with your question, Joe, K2RIW in the tech net.
Thanks, Dick. I have a student who just got his general license, lives in New York City, so he's vertically and horizontally restricted as to any type of HF antenna. Many years ago, I think in the 70s, I think, and please underline the word think, I remember reading an article about building a bazooka, double bazooka dipole, where you would wrap the ends of the dipole, each leg of the dipole, around a large plastic tube. and use that as, and hang it out your window and use that as an HF antenna. Have you ever heard of such a thing, or do you remember such an antenna? Back to you, Dick.
I don't remember a website with a picture of what you're describing yet. However, we have over the years had a number of guys who take the helical wound 27 megacycle citizen band antennas, which are quite a bit shorter because of the helical winding, and put a pair of those back to back to make a dipole. Now, there's various ways you can squeeze down a dipole. Helical winding, loading coil, top hat capacitors, zigzagging it, bending down the ends and whatever. The hard thing to believe is that no matter how you shrink down a dipole, if you took an 80 meter dipole, it's supposed to be 132 feet long, as you've heard me say so often, and you squeeze it down 10 or 20 or 30 feet long, a very small fraction of the usual physical length. And then by whatever means, either a broadband antenna tuner, or you put a tuning network in there, an LC network, an L pad, so to speak, an inductor and a capacitor, where the center tap goes to the dipole, and one end goes to ground, the other end goes to the center conductor of the coax cable. If by one means or another, you take this infinitesimal dipole and force it into resonance at your favorite frequency, it'll give you full performance. Within half a dB, you get the exact same gain as the full length, 132 feet of a dipole on 80 meters, in my example. Can we drop? So now your task is to choose some method of making as much of the electrical length as you can with helical winding and physical length with a long piece of PVC pipe, for instance, and you put helical windings on it. There's all kinds of ways you can make that such that it doesn't exceed the dimensions of the room or whatever area he's got. But then by various techniques, with a good dip meter, with an antenna analyzer or whatever, by putting loading capacitors, loading coils and so on, you eventually make that antenna resonate. That's your highest priority, make it resonate. Your second highest priority is to make sure that it comes out in the vicinity of 50 or 70 ohms as far as the resistive component is concerned. That's nowhere near as important, believe it or not. Resonance is the most important. Once you force it into resonance, even inside the house, you'll be amazed what kind of performance you're going to get out of it. So I know I haven't given you an exact answer, but I've given you a path by which you can get to an answer, Joe. And with the right kind of Googling, I know that there are some websites out there where guys have done this exact problem. A very restricted amount of volume of the house where the antenna's got to be located, and yet the antenna gives fairly high performance. There are a number of articles like that. I'm going to do a little bit of looking during the next week and see if I can find one for you. W2BMP, K2RIW in the TechNet. I drag your feet a little bit, Joe, just in case there's somebody listening to us that says, I've got the antenna for you. W2BMP with a delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
Okay, Wes, are you about to make a brief comment on this subject? Go ahead, Wes.
The easiest way is the screwdriver antenna or any kind of motorized antenna made for the car. Works like a charm. I did it many years ago. And you don't have to have anything apart from just a plate of metal beneath it, serving as a counterpoint. Central cheer.
Yeah, thank you, Wes. So a screwdriver antenna, that's certainly a candidate. I heard another very weak signal, very low in audio, somebody who said he's got a comment. Who was that? K2RIW in the TechNet.
MSJ sells hamsticks, and they also sell a mount where you can mount two hamsticks together end to end to form a dipole. Short, sweet, tunable.
Okay, that was Richard from Floral Park. That's a good suggestion there, Rich. You might want to know that your audio is about 10 dB lower that it should be. Maybe it's one of these Luxon radios that are built with super narrow audio, and you're going to have to shout into that mic for people to hear you. Lucky for me, I got earphones on, or I'd never be able to hear your audio that low. So, any further comments on that one, Rich, WB2GXM, T2LIW?
Well, I'm sure I'm the only one selling them. I've seen these mounts on eBay. The basic thing is the mount mounts two ham sticks end to end to form a dipole, much like a body pole, but a lot cheaper. And you've got the John, I guess I'm going to have to hook up a mobile rig one of these days soon. Thanks, Dick. WB2GXM for testing it out.
Very fine, Rich. I can tell you shouted into the microphone a little bit louder that time. You need all the audio you can give us with that particular rig. And I've got a couple of those Luxons, and I know what they're like. My goodness, are they narrow on audio. So, Joe, I guess you've got some slight suggestions for the beginning of this project, and I know it's doable, and the average person believes, with good common sense, that if I build a dipole on, say, 80 meters, and I make it one-tenth the length, everyone believes you're going to get one-tenth the area, one-tenth the performance. Absolutely not true. As long as you make it resonant, and then impedance match it, so to speak, the so-called infinitesimal dipole that John Krause, in his book on antennas, described that, and it's opposite of common sense. The magic of resonance gives you all that effective capture area. The actual physical length of the antenna is less important. I will admit that when you make a super small dipole in length, it's going to be a lot more narrow band. You're going to have to retune it every time you QSY. But other than that, it can give you full performance. And let us know how this project works out in the future, Joe. W2BMP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, Dick, that was incredibly helpful, and I'm going to try that. And if anybody does come across any articles on it, I would love to hear about it. And you can email me at w2bmp@livemark.org. Thanks again for everybody's time. Great suggestions and great advice. I'm going to give it a shot. Back to you. Have a good evening.
It's good that you've got the enthusiasm to go and try. You'd be amazed how many people will say, gee, I have so little area in my backyard, or the antenna's got to be inside the house. I've got so little area in the house, therefore I can't put an antenna on these bands. And they just give up the project, and they give up prematurely. So lots of guys have built miniature antennas. There's a couple of commercial products that are loop-like antennas with a great big tuning capacitor in that loop, multi-turn loop. I can't think of the name of the damn brand name right now. Yeah. You know the brand name I'm talking about, John? KC2WGB? Who's the guy that makes it, the compact indoor antenna? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Dick, I don't know. You know, it was there and it's gone. No, don't remember.
It's called an Alex loop. Is that what you're referring to, Dick?
That may be the brand, that may be the type, but there's a brand name of an antenna that's popular 10, 20 years ago. Anybody know the brand name of this multi-turn loop-like antenna with a great big tuning capacitor in it that tunes through many of the HF frequencies? It's an indoor antenna. Anybody with a suggestion, give me a call, let us, K2RIW.
UPS might know.
West, you know the brand name of that antenna?
Yeah, the loop antenna I don't, but the antenna that was used 20 years ago now is known as the Scorpion screwdriver antenna. It's an antenna that I would suggest you might put it on the swivel so it's lies horizontally, and then you may, by press of the button, you can make it to be vertical, and then since it's motorized, it operates from 80 to 10 meters, no problem. Small one, 1 kilowatt of power. So again, Scorpion screwdriver antenna, or plenty of others of this guy. Intuition.
Intuition.
sounds like Dave. You're a little bit weak, but give it a go, Dave. Maybe you know the brand name of that that compact antenna.
Yeah, my old brain cells are coming up with Isotron. Does that ring a bell? It's a loop antenna.
That's the one. Give that man a cigar. Isotron. So if that still exists, a very compact indoor loop-like antenna, multi-turn loop. It's only a couple of feet in diameter. And because you can so easily rotate it on its vertical mast, you can aim it, so to speak. You can aim the pattern of the antenna. It's the equivalent of a fully rotatable dipole on each of those bands, and the performance is darn good. That Isotron is the brand name we were trying to think of. We've gone down the list of people who signed in with a question, and nobody left. And we've gone beyond our usual hour, but it's a very loose schedule we follow. We're now going to the mailbag. And so some of these mailbag questions that John gets, sometimes they're really fantastic. KC2WGB, K2RIW. You've got the floor, John.
Just let it drop. Okay. KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yep, got a waveguide question here at 3 gig. Hope I can explain this one right, but let me let it drop. I'll go on with the question. Okay, he's working at approximately 3 gig. He has a piece of waveguide, and he has a question. If he puts a Y connection of this rectangular waveguide, and he's sending two signals down, and they're approximately a megahertz apart in frequency, will those two signals stay independent going down the waveguide? This is the first part of the question. There's no partitions, nothing in the waveguide but rectangular waveguide. That's it. And he'd like to know, both of those signals will go down and they will maintain their independence and be received out the other side of the waveguide with no problem. Is that true? That's his first question.
Yeah, darn good question. Using good common sense, the answer is very opposite of common sense. You know that in the New York City area, there are zillions and zillions of broadcast transmitters, AM, FM, television, two-way radios, all kinds of radio signals. All those radio signals are going through the air, crisscrossing each other, and in the air itself, those signals do not mix in any way. Each signal behaves as if it's all by itself, and all other signals on all other frequencies are not there. Air does that. Waveguide does that. It's really the kind of, it's a beautiful demonstration of the law of superposition, also the law of conservation of energy, a whole lot of these laws. If you put one signal down one of the ports of your waveguide, and you look at the way the waveguide behaves on that signal, on that frequency, you make all these measurements, and you put the second signal all by itself, and you look at how the waveguide behaves on all those ports on that particular frequency. Then you put the two signals on the two separate frequencies simultaneously down the waveguide. At each one of those ports, you will see signal A. You will see signal A will be exactly the way it was when only A was there. Signal B will be exactly the way it was when only B was there. And now that you've got A and B simultaneously, your spectrum analyzer will show you the A signal and the B signal on their frequency. Absolutely no mixing. The waveguide is a thoroughly linear device, equally as linear as that air that has zillions of signals going through it right now, where the air does absolutely no mixing. Let me drop. You go to the top of the Empire State Building with your handy talkie, because there's so darn many signals, so strong. You will overload the front end of your handy talkie, something fierce, and you'll hear a whole bunch of phony signals. You've got a whole lot of crazy mixing going on. All of that mixing is taking place in the front end of your overloaded handy talkie in your hand. Air did not do that. The original transmitters did not do that. Only your handy talkie did it. So you've got to be careful what instrumentation you're using when you're putting multiple signals down a waveguide. But the waveguide keeps all of those common sense. You dig deep enough into it, you'll see those very pleasant results from my point of view. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good. All right, we got the first part down. Now, his next question is, again, without any partitions or anything added, if he put another Y connector at the end of the waveguide, by adjusting the length or possibly the phase relationship of the two signals, is it possible to receive the individual channel from the two ports one at a time? Would he be able to separate those signals, or would he get basically 50% of the signal out of each? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Now, what you're calling a Y connector sounds like a three-port piece of waveguide. Sounds like it's a kind of power divider. Maybe it does or doesn't have isolation. One port, we're going to call it the common port, the input port, and the other two ports we'll call it an output port, if you're using it as a power divider. So a power divider being used as a power summer, you're using it backwards, so to speak, is putting two signals down a piece of waveguide, and then at the other end of that waveguide, you use another one of these power dividers, now as a power divider. Once again, you can put any one signal into any one port of this particular system, measure the way all the other ports behave, and put in the second signal all by itself, measure the way all the ports behave. Now you put the two signals in simultaneously, each one of those ports will show you the exact same amplitude of the exact same signal. Now, the fact that you've combined two signals in the waveguide, and now at the far end, you would like signal A only come out to the left-hand port, and signal B to come out to the right-hand port.
He's a circulator.
Yeah, he's got a circulator-like device, but that's not the way he's using it. I don't think he's got a circulator. By the way, a circulator with 3 gigs would be a very big, massive device. But if you want only signal A to come out one of those divider ports at the far end, and signal B to come out only the other port, you have to use some kind of waveguide filtering in those ports. Without any filtering, the way it behaves with one signal at a time and the way it behaves with two signals simultaneously is going to be identical, following the law of superposition.
Repeater, time out.
It's got to follow the law of superposition. Now, because the two signals are on two separate frequencies, if you're using the right kind of a receiver, you can tune the receiver to signal A at that frequency, then you can tune another receiver to signal B. The receivers can do the separation for you. But if you want the waveguide to do frequency separation, you got to do some pretty fancy filtering in the waveguide itself. Very doable, but that gets into a whole lot of other complications as to how you put in stubs and partitions and apertures and walls and whatever to do frequency selecting within waveguide. That's a whole art and science itself. I'm about to say it's difficult. Depends on your experience and what book you're reading. But waveguide in the general ham radio mind is fairly poorly understood. After I came out of my Bachelor of Engineering school in electrical engineering, specializing in communications, and being given special courses on waveguide by the guy who taught the waveguide course, I walked out of there thinking that, boy, I'm never going to work with waveguide. This stuff is boring as all hell and much too complicated. That's the way they convinced me. Let me drop it. And then I started working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I ran into a guy named Hank Keane, W2CTK, who had cut his teeth on waveguide 25 years before I met him, and was doing that work for 25 solid years, and he had simple ways of explaining it. He made waveguide fun. It doesn't have to be hard. The fact that the courses and the books make it very hard and hard to understand doesn't mean it is always hard to understand. You get the right person teaching you how waveguide works, you might fall in love with it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. Well, I'm going to assume that he is going to have a 3 dB loss, basically, when he's using this thing because of that division at the end. Is that correct?
If he's got a Y at the beginning, giving him 3 dB of loss before he starts, and another Y at the end, giving him another 3 dB of loss, depending on how you reference things, you could end up with 6 dB of loss altogether. However, the waveguide itself does not dissipate any energy, per se, unless you've got 100 feet of it, so to speak. So all the power you put into that waveguide, every milliwatt of it is going to come out somewhere. So is it real loss? It's an interesting question. If I put 2 milliwatts into a power divider, and each one of the outputs is 1 milliwatt, from an input to output characteristic of one of those output ports, I think I've got 3 dB of loss. But if I realize that I put in 2 milliwatts and all together I'm getting 2 milliwatts out, there never really was any loss as long as you look at the big picture correctly. So from that point of view, there isn't any loss per se, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, very good. I'm sure that he'll be able to work this out and make him happy. Yeah. Well, if he has the Y connector and in each one of those ports he's putting a milliwatt into it, I think what he's going to wind out, that particular frequency he's looking for at the other end, he's going to wind up with a half a milliwatt of that particular signal. Yeah, if you sum both of them, you'd have the full milliwatt, but I think he's going to wind up with a 3 dB loss on the signal he's going to look to examine.
That sounds approximately right, John. But all the power you put in that really gets into the waveguide, it's going to come out somewhere. With reasonably short lengths of waveguide, there is no loss. It runs ice cold, no matter what power level you're running at, so to speak, as long as you don't arc it over. So from the right point of view, there is no loss. But if you're power dividing, you'll think you've got 3 dB loss on each one of those outputs. Over to you, John.
KC2QAQ with the counter.
Go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beeps.
The only thing that just sounds a little funny to me, Dick, is that when it was mentioned before that this was 3 gigahertz, and John and you were just talking about milliwatts, this sounds like, you know, why would he be using coaxial cable? And if he is really using waveguide here at 3 gigahertz, it's got to be a monster-sized waveguide, never mind with Ys on either end. I'm just wondering, does he know if he's using the correct frequency of waveguide? Because waveguide is very, very frequency-dependent. I'm going to pass back to you, Zach. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In order for a signal to go down a rectangular waveguide, the major dimension of the waveguide must be greater than a half wavelength. If his waveguide, if he's really using waveguide at 3 gigs, a good piece of waveguide at 3 gigs would be, let's see, 10 gigs is 0.9 inches wide. The 3 gigs is roughly one-third of that, three times, 2.8 inches. The waveguide's got to be more than 2.8 inches wide to easily pass that signal. Well, waveguide, 2.7, let's go 3 inches wide. 3-inch wide waveguide is big by normal ham radio service standards. Compared to the kinds of waveguides that are kinds of radars that are running at S-band, a 3-inch wide waveguide is pretty ordinary stuff, per se. So it's pretty big, but it's not huge. The waveguide that they used out at Montauk Point on the FPS-35 radar that runs at 400 megahertz, that waveguide was a couple of feet wide. That's a big waveguide. It looks like air conditioning ductwork for an industrial building. But you can easily measure the number of inches of the waveguide. You can easily calculate what is free space wavelength. If the horizontal width of the waveguide, the major dimension, is half wavelength or greater, it will propagate your signal. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet. And by the way, the other dimension of the waveguide is anything you want. As long as this waveguide, in his case, is close to 3 inches wide, whether the small dimension of the waveguide is an eighth of an inch, 2 inches, or 20 inches doesn't matter. As long as one of the dimensions has at least half wavelength of width, the other dimension doesn't matter as far as whether or not the signal will go there.
Repeater, time out.
I will admit that as you start changing the other dimension, you could say you're making high impedance waveguide if it's a high dimension, or a low impedance waveguide if it's a, you know, two horizontal plates very close to each other. You're changing the apparent impedance of the waveguide, but the signal will still go there. Just as long as one of the dimensions is a half wave or greater. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
AC2WGB. Yeah, Glenn is absolutely right. I can tell by the bolt pattern. Those look like quarter-inch bolts going into the flanges, and it looks to me like it's about 3.5 inches by 2.5 inches, somewhere roughly around there. Big, heavy stuff with thick flanges. So I don't know what he tends to do with this, but that's why I had a question. But yeah, absolutely right, Glenn.
Yeah, there are standard gauge horns that work at those frequencies. There's all kinds of large objects you can put on in that waveguide. It's also a beautiful learning technique as to how waveguide behaves. At some later time, if he owns that piece of waveguide and he's willing to drill holes in it and then put screws into the waveguide, into the broad wall, as tuning stubs, or you can do all kinds of fancy things. You can build what's called evanescent filters. You can build impedance matching devices and so on by doing very simple things where the hole you're drilling in the side of the waveguide is very small in diameter compared to wavelength. A quarter-inch bolt is a very small fraction of a wavelength. So if you remove the bolt and you leave that hole there and don't cover it up, don't worry about it. The signal will not come squirting out of that hole. It cannot do that. But when you've got that bolt in that hole as a tuning device, you can make the equivalent of a double stub tuner in that waveguide by putting a couple of bolts going into it. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
KC2WGB. I'm sure you can have a lot of fun with this. I wish he would let me know. He didn't give me the exact dimensions, but I wish he'd let me know what he was trying to do here. But interesting question. All right, let me little drop. I'll go on to my next scientist here. This kid is a riot. Alrighty, we have a question from this young student. He's interested in about different colored lenses for making light colors like red, blue, and green and such. So he takes a basic 63 Kelvin lamp or a white lamp and puts these lenses in front. They are glass lenses, and he wants to know what is actually happening. When the white light goes through the red lens, is it only passing the red portion of the spectrum? Or is it just illuminating the lens and the lens is transmitting the red color itself? He'd like to know how those filters work if you have any information on that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, most Raten filters. It's a certain style of filters that you put into a Series 7 holder and you put it in front of your lens of your 35mm camera. Those are band pass filters. You buy the right photographic book which describes each of those filters. They've all got a number. A number 28 filter, for instance, a 26 is the one that's a deep red. They are band pass filters. You give it white light and only the red portion of the spectrum is allowed to pass through. All the other spectrums, all the other pieces get attenuated. But now, there's something funny going on with color. If I had a real, true, deep red filter that passed nothing but red, I've got another filter that's a band pass filter passing nothing but, let me think now. The primary colors are red, green, and blue. Yeah, I got another one passing blue, another one passing green. I got these three filters, three separate light bulbs, a white light bulb going through three separate filters, and now the output of those, I combine them. I've recombined and I've made white light. Your eye will see white. If you have the right kind of an optical spectrum analyzer, on that screen. A red one, a green one, and a blue one, and nothing in between. Each of those is a bandpass filter. The human eye, let me drop it. The color receptors in your eye are cones that respond to red, cones that respond to green, cones that respond to blue. When the right ratio of red, green, and blue cones get excited, the brain puts that together and says, aha, I think that's white. It's not white. It looks like white. With a spectrum analyzer, you'll see the three separate colors. You take the real output of the sun and you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, it is a broadband signal. It's a very broad signal starting off at the below red and going up beyond blue, if you know what I mean. It is broadband. Your eye sees that as white. Your eye gets fooled into thinking red, green, and blue combined are white. It's not. So there are colors you can make by combining things like pink. Pink is a certain mixture of colors that you've made with filters. You're about to ask the question, what wavelength is pink? It doesn't have a wavelength. It's a mixture of certain colors to a bandpass filter that your eye calls it pink. So color perception with a human eye, color perception with a spectrum analyzer, what's really going on, there's a lot more than meets the eye. There's a pun here somewhere. Who are you, John? K2LIW.
Oh, absolutely true. And, if he does a little research, he can also find out about the color spectrum and those three colors, red, blue, and green. There's a certain percentage, as they did in the NTSC system, where, you need a certain percentage of blue and green and red, and they're different. They're not as bright. And he could find out a lot of information about mixing those colors. Interesting stuff. Eric probably remembers those numbers. I don't remember them offhand.
In the old days, the red phosphors that were on color picture tubes was much lower in efficiency. Therefore, you had a really blast with a whole lot of beam current, the red dots, in order to get enough red. I know they've almost corrected that. I'll bet you Eric did do an awful lot of experimenting at one time with various colors and the various kinds of cathode ray tubes and so on. If Eric is there, we'll have him give us a few words on that. KE2EJ if you want to. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Let me just point out to you that cones are the ones that are color sensitive. Rods are sort of brightness sensitive. Actually, they're more sensitive to the upper wavelength. May I suggest to you that when you look on a spectrograph, that the sensitivity of the cones within the eyes, or even many bandpass filters as you've described them, are not a single angstrom wide. They each have a certain bandpass within the range of what we call that color. Back in the early 70s, actually, I had a device which was called a flying spot scanner, which the manufacturer used photomultipliers and the scanners and, in essence, bandpass filters to separate the red, green, and blue portions of the film frame that you're transferring the video. And actually, one of the gentlemen that I knew, that his closest friend was actually the chief engineer at Kodak, and we had them make bandpass filters that precisely matched the dye couplers in the film. Let it drop. And essentially what you did was you took these bandpass filters and converted it into brightness information, and that would in turn get matrixed out into red, green, and blue in the appropriate proportions where the eyeball has sensitivity. There's something called a CIE curve that actually spells out what the eye does, and the eye does mostly green, and next it does red, and at least is blue. Actually, in a television signal, 11% of the signal is blue. Anyway, that's just a little bit. And the interesting thing you can do with not only bandpass filters, but what we call dichroic filters, is we can allow a specific color, a specific bandwidth of a color to pass and reflect the others that remain. K
K2RIW, K2J.
So what I think you're saying, Eric, is that the colors that are not getting through the filter in the forward direction, the other colors that are being rejected, so to speak, don't have to be absorbed. In some cases, they're being sent in some other direction or reflected, depending on the style of the filter. When it comes to the human eye, there's a lot more that goes on there than first meets the eye. The center of the eye, which has the so-called macula, the high sensitivity area, and the center of that called the fovea, is 90-some-odd% cones. Those cones are color sensitive, high in resolution, but low in sensitivity. Outside of your macula is where you have a much higher percentage of rods, but the rods only see black and white. They don't see color. But when the eye is dark adapted, in other words, you go into a dark room or out into a very dark backyard, so to speak, and wait approximately 20 minutes.
Scotopic.
That's called scotopic vision as opposed to photopic vision. Your bright daylight is called photopic vision. But you wait until your eye becomes dark adapted, when you're now exciting the scotopic vision. That's where the rods start becoming super sensitive. And those rods are, I don't know the exact number, 10 or 20 dB more sensitive than the cone. So therefore, at nighttime, when you look at a dim star, you use what's called averted vision. In other words, you don't look directly at it. You look slightly off to one side. You're now exciting the rods instead of the cones, and you will see that star. You aim your eye straight at the star, and it disappears, because now you're expecting the cones to pick it up, and the cones have less sensitivity. So, and by the way, it takes a good 20 minutes, in some cases 30 minutes, for the eye to come up to full sensitivity with dark adaptation. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
And once you get that dark adaptation, you have to make sure your eye is always looking at a dark environment. You suddenly, if somebody turns on the headlights of a car, you'll lose your dark adaptation. In the old days when movie theaters didn't have as bright a projector as they do nowadays, and you're at a matinee, you know, you're going to a movie at high noon, and you're coming out at 3 in the afternoon in the summertime. In the old days when you walked from that movie theater to outdoors, it was painful. Your eyes had been dark adapted by that movie theater, and now you come out into normal sunlight, and that sunlight was way too bright for you. You were seeing the effect of your eye dark adaptation, if you know what I mean. So if you want to see certain things at night, certain dim constellations and things like that, like the Andromeda galaxy, which is very observable with a naked eye if you're in a dark enough area, you might have to wait until your eyes are dark adapted. Let me drop.
Too wild.
Bernie recognized. I remember walking down a long dark road in my town of Middle Island one time, and there was a huge aurora borealis going on to the north, and I was walking to the north, and boy, I could see it. With my eyes, it was bright as all hell. The guy who was my next door neighbor, who worked for Brookhaven Laboratory, I said, John, you got to come see this. Come out in the backyard and look at this. And he says, what are you talking about? I said, look at that going on the horizon. He didn't see it. I didn't know about the amount of time it takes for dark adaptation. Not only was his eyes, 40-year-old eyes, and mine were 18-year-old eyes at the time. That's a factor. But still, he hadn't had the 20 minutes to get dark adapted in order to see that aurora. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Next.
Question about this specific subject. Why in submarines and military operations do they use red light